Very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawa'ij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kazim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام قيل للقمان ما يجمع من حكمتك قال لا أسأل عما كفيته ولا أتكلف ما لا يعنيني.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, Luqman was asked, what is the crux of your wisdom? He replied, I do not ask about that which I know already, and I do not burden myself with that which does not concern me.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When talking about the beautiful dialogues of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that this divinely appointed imam spoke about how we need to organize our time. And when we organize our time, we are able to organize the affairs of our life, and we are able to educate our souls. In one of these conversations that Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam had with his companions had asked them on how we should organize our time. Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam responded and advised his companions by saying, "Try hard that your time may be divided into 4 hours." Now here, just as a little side note, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam is talking about 4 parts of one's life when he is referring to hours. And then the divinely appointed imam says, 1 hour is for supplicating to Allah the Almighty. 1 hour is for the affairs of one's livelihood, meaning going to work or having a job and earning our livelihood. 1 hour is for associating with our brothers, our friends, and the reliable people who let us know our defects and are inwardly loyal to us. And finally, the 4th hour is that we should be alone with ourselves and, of course, not indulge in non-forbidden and haram things while we are in that seclusion and in that isolation. Now, a very beautiful conversation here, and very beautifully Imam Al-Kadhim explained these 4 parts that one should split up their life into, or their daily life into. 1 part is for the supplication to Allah, whether it's our prayers, wajibat, obligatory prayers, our supplications, our du'as, our litanies, different things such as those, the recitation of the Holy Quran. And again, 1 hour or 1 part, which is for seeking our livelihood, whether it's going to work or in certain situations going to school. Another hour is to be able to hang out with friends, spend time with good friends. And it doesn't say any kind of friends. It is friends that let us know our defects and friends who are inwardly loyal to us. And finally, the last hour in which we are alone and we get a chance to reflect and contemplate upon our lives, our future, our past, our present, etc. And again, beautiful things put forth in this conversation by the infallible Imam. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imama of Imam Al-Kadhim salamullah alayhi very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movement of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. The objective of it was to overthrow the regime. Now, before the Abbasids, it was the Umayyads. But it doesn't matter who is there, as long as it's not the government of the Ahlul Bayt, the government of God's laws, and it must be removed. The movement of the Ahlul Bayt continues. To keep this movement alive, not just keep Shias believing in the Ahlul Bayt, believing that we need to go to the Ahlul Bayt as teachers and learn our ahkam. When we want to go to Hajj, we learned the ahkam of Hajj from Imam Al-Kadhim. Not that. That was not perhaps very difficult if it was limited to that. There were various schools of thoughts and various ideologies that were around, and leaders of those ideologies, those schools of thought, were able to teach and promote their views. There wasn't much resistance against them, unless they had a political agenda, which the Ahlul Bayt clearly did, salamullah alayhim ajma'in.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
The deceit and lies and cover-ups of the worst moments in post-9/11 history have created an endless stage of hypocrisy for all the world to see, says Elise Swain, author, in an article published under the heading, The Truth Never Mattered at Guantanamo. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Army Staff Sergeant Joseph Hickman was on guard duty at Guantanamo Bay in a tower with the entire prison complex sprawled out beneath him when he saw a white prison transport van drive from Alpha Block toward the prison entrance gate. It was the evening of June 9, 2006. Once the van passed through the gate, it made an unusual left turn. The only possible destination for detainees in that direction was a CIA black site, some of the guards refer to as Camp No, because officially it did not exist. As the sun was setting, after the detainees had their evening meal, Hickman observed the van driving twice more toward the facility. Hours later, three detainees were declared dead. The official explanation that the government has maintained for 16 years this week is an unbelievable version of events that has been ripped apart in later reporting. The Navy says the men killed themselves by hanging in separate, non-adjoining cells in the same way, at the same time, under video surveillance, with no guards noticing and no prisoners calling for the guards to intervene. They tell us that each of the men had bound their wrists and ankles with fabric and shoved fabric down their own throats, and then ask us to believe that they hung themselves. Despite explosive reporting by Scott Horton for Harper's Magazine, in which multiple sources, including Hickman, refuted the official narrative and gave evidence that a cover-up had taken place, no independent official investigation of the incident was ordered. The Department of Justice, asked to look into the Navy's unbelievable explanation of events, eventually reviewed the allegations of cover-up and found no evidence of wrongdoing. This disturbing episode quickly turned unspeakably dark. Independent autopsies ordered by the families of the dead were useless since the bodies, which showed signs of torture, had been sent home with missing parts. The men's throats, the larynx, the hyoid bone, and the thyroid cartilage had been removed. Even after this shocking finding, the door was closed. There would be no investigations. Hickman went on to publish a book titled Murder at Camp Delta. For the American public, the loss of three unknown terrorists to suicide at Guantanamo prison was a passing story, if it registered at all, in the endless news cycle of America's so-called war on terror. But for Mansour Adyafi, an innocent Yemeni man trapped in Guantanamo, it was night everything changed. He knew the three men he told Intercept. They had protested together, gone on hunger strike together, put themselves through hell to demand basic rights and human decency. In his memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Adyafi lays out his own account of that summer night. Mere hours after the men died, a devastated Adyafi was interrogated and beaten over the incident. Former detainees Mohammed Salhi and Ahmed Irachidi said in an interview that their cells, even in solitary confinement, were searched that night. The dead men, Salah Ahmed Al-Salami, 37, Mani Shaman Otyabi, 30, and Yasser Talal Al-Zahrani, 22, all of whom had been held without charge, were attacked by the camp commander. They are smart, they are creative, they are committed, Rear Admiral Harry B. Harris Jr. said, adding, they have no regard for life, neither ours nor their own. I believe this was not an act of desperation, but an act of asymmetrical warfare waged against us. Angry guards and interrogators, embarrassed by the event, embarked on a month-long crackdown. Nothing made sense, Adyafi writes, adding, none of the brothers had talked about suicide. None of us had. We had just survived the hunger strike together. Conditions at the camp had gotten better, and we were preparing to strike again for even more changes. In Murder at Camp Delta, Hickman writes that none of his guards, who had a clear view of the camp and the medical clinic, saw any detainees moved from their cells to the clinic. Hickman himself watched the white van return to camp and drive directly to the clinic, though he was unable to see what was unloaded from the van because his view was blocked. Two guards who had unobstructed views of the walkways connecting the clinic with the cell blocks confirmed to Horton that they had seen no prisoners taken there from the cells. Hickman and Adyafi remained steadfast in the conclusion that it was impossible that these men died by suicide in their cells. This was murder, Hickman said, adding, I think about it every single day. Adyafi explains that he and his brothers, fellow detainees, always did everything in their power to prevent a suicide from occurring. I can't say exactly what happened, he told me. Something, they were killed. Additional mysterious deaths followed over the years. In all, 9 detainees have died at the prison. Allegations of cover-ups emerged, but the deaths remained shrouded in secrecy. With few exceptions, no one really cared. Even the preposterous story put forward about these suicides failed to shock the public into condemning the ongoing travesty of justice that Guantanamo represents. The narrative that these men did something terrible and deserved to be imprisoned for it defines the very nature of the post-9/11 response. It doesn't matter that the original accusations against many of them were flimsy and easily disapproved. Due process and presumption of innocence, the defining values of the American ideal of justice, would be forever denied them. The vague language of enemy combatants and terrorists dehumanized men across the West Asia region to the point at which the U.S. was able to commit profound abuses of human rights with impunity and public support. Americans were convinced in the years after 9/11 that the men locked in Guantanamo were being killed in drone strikes abroad or tortured in CIA black sites were sworn enemies of the U.S. regime who deserved to die before they could cause more senseless death. And so the atrocities followed, committed over multiple administrations on a global battlefield where U.S. forces played judge, jury, and executioner against terrorists and enemy combatants who also happened to be farmers, taxi drivers, mothers, children, producing an unbearable human toll exposed only by painstaking reporting. Renewing calls for justice for the men who died at Guantanamo feels like an exercise in futility, yet those permanently maimed by Guantanamo refuse to stop seeking justice. I would like to see the people that were behind it held responsible, but it's never gonna happen, Hickman says, adding, I think it was murder, and it should never go away. It should be investigated until it's solved. The deceit and lies and cover-ups of the worst moments in post-9/11 history have created an endless stage of hypocrisy for all the world to see. Ahmad Eradici, a Moroccan chef, wrongly imprisoned for years at Guantanamo, said that the longer the injustice at the detention camp continues, the more damage it does to the reputation and legacy of American culture, American principles, and American morals. He called for former Guantanamo detainees to be allowed to finally testify before Congress and for victims of CIA torture to be allowed to take the American government to court.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a shorter speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
هست که خداوند متعال به حضرت موسی فرمود که یا موسی یک موجودی رو که از خودت پستر هست
It is narrated that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala asked Prophet Moses to bring him a creature lower than himself. By such a request, Allah wanted to examine Moses a divine test. Prophet Moses obeyed and went out to fight a human lower than himself in rank. However, wherever he looked, he couldn't find such a creature. Allah told Prophet Moses, O Moses, if you brought someone to us, you would lose your rank of prophethood. The lesson we take from this request of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the reaction of Prophet Moses is that we must not consider ourselves higher than others in our lives. Every creature has a benefit. One good example was the late Ayatollah Bahauddini. He always considered himself the lowest among all, and when he was invited to a gathering, he used to sit down at the entrance or the least cited place of the room. His high status and knowledge never let him be proud or arrogant.
عالم دینی پیغمبر فرمود اگه توقع داشته باشه مردم جلو پاش بلندشن
اگه توقع Prophet Muhammad stated a religious scholar and alim must never expect the people to rise at his arrival or to obey him like a servant. If he does so, he must wait for the hellfire in the other worlds. Of course, the people must respect their religious authorities too. However, this respect must not lead into arrogance or self-centerism of the scholar. Therefore, modesty and sense of humbleness is required for all the people, especially the scholars and ulama. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
شیخ باقر شریف القرشی decides to compile
so we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was
when we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Kamerayi that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
بسم
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to talk about one of the most outstanding fuqaha and religious authorities of the Shiite world. He is no one but Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari, who is known by founding the Islamic Seminary of Hujjatiyah or Madrasa Hujjatiyah in the holy city of Qom. We will, of course, talk about this foundation and this school and this Islamic seminary in Qom. But before that, I'll be happy with Sheikh Ziyaniya giving us some information about the early life of Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari was born in the 29th day of Sha'ban, according to lunar calendar, in the year of 1310. His family are scholar family, and there are many scholars brought up in this family, amongst which is his father and also his two sons. And he was from Sadat, as his name is explaining it, Sayyid Muhammad. So his lineage goes back to Imam As-Sajjad, alayhi salam, the fourth Imam of Shia school of thought. And his father, Sayyid Ali, was born in Tabriz, and he moved to Najaf to study Islamic studies.
That's right.
And his father continued his Islamic studies up to the higher levels, and we may say that his father also was close to ijtihad.
That's right.
Or even we may say that his father also was a mujtahid.
Okay.
It's better. Yeah.
Okay. What about his teachers?
His teachers are amongst, of course, we should mention this point that Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat is not only, expert in a single field.
Mm-hmm.
He decided to study different fields of studies, amongst which is, for example, mathematics.
Okay, yes.
And also medicine.
Medicine, okay.
He completed his primary studies with his father, that was his teacher also. And then after that, beside being a student, started his teaching. That, this is a manner of most of the scholars in Islamic seminary.
That's right.
And then from Tabriz, he moved to Najaf at the year of 1330 to continue his Islamic studies in higher levels.
Mm-hmm.
And at that level, he studied fiqh, usul, hadith, and rijal with these teachers like Sheikh al-Sharia Isfahani, Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani, the great marja of Shia, Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri, Mirza Muhammad Hussein Na'ini, and Ziauddin Araghi. That all these figures great figures and great scholars in the galaxy of Shia.
Truly they are. Okay, Sheikh Mahdavi, what about his migration to the city of Qom and his stay up to the last moment of his life? He migrates to Qom, he founds a school over here. After his demise, even he's buried in his own school. Let's talk about these details of the life of Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Before we talk about his move to Qom, we have to say that he actually didn't want to come back to Iran.
Oh.
When he left Tabriz for the first time and he went to Najaf because of the bad situation, the weather situation, he got sick and his father demanded him to go back to Iran. You cannot tolerate this situation. For a short period of time, he stayed in Tabriz. Again, he moved back to Najaf, but he realized that this condition, he cannot tolerate. So he was forced to come back to Iran. This time he chose Qom to stay. Why? Because of the scholarly environment of the Qom. When he comes to Qom at that time, we have to acknowledge the role of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri Yazdi as a founder of the seminary school of Qom.
Oh, that's right.
Although he is a great, outstanding marja of that time, but this is also important that Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Qamari didn't benefit as a student, but as a matter of respect, he would go to his classes, he would participate in his lessons.
Okay.
Mistakenly, some of the biographers
have noted his name as the prominent student of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'eri Yazdi while he was not the student, only as a matter of respect, as my brother mentioned. He was really, he has said that he has been refraining from fame. And this is one of the very important things.
Yes, yes.
So by the time he moved back to Qom, he was at the level of ijtihad. He didn't actually need to participate anymore in these classes, which are prepared for the elementary students. Okay. By the way, as a matter of respect, he participated in the classes of the Sheikh Abdul Karim.
This is an akhlaqi point for all the scholars, you know?
Yes, definitely.
Even at very high ranks, they participate at their, we can say, gathering and courses on different lessons on Islamic studies. This shows the respect that they had for each other.
And that's why we see that he earned the respect and trust of Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'eri Yazdi, and he recommended him to lead the Salat.
Oh.
Yes, and even after him, he delegated the leadership of the school to him and to other scholars. Yes, Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr and the other one.
Okay.
So he was really at the very high level of the knowledge and also akhlaq. And when we look at his life and the services that he bestowed and granted the students, we see from the great favors for the students at that time, we see this establishment of the school of Hujjatiyya.
That's right.
That many students or many people might be familiar with this name. Madrasatul Hujjatiyya.
Yes, most of the people might not know that this Hujjatiyya is named after Hujjat Kukameri, okay?
Yes.
Even maybe some of the Persians or Iranians, even the students do not know that why this name is, can I say, put on the name of the school. There is a bridge, you know, to give geographical information, there is a bridge by the name of Hujjatiyya Bridge and then Hujjatiyya School. And today is the, you know, the gathering place for so many of the students, also the foreign students, spirit to say.
Yeah.
The foreign students,
today
the
it's Tullab. It's only dedicated for the foreign students. It's
that's
not
right.
anymore for the Iranian ones.
The Tullab and the Islamic seminary students that come from outside Iran, you know, enroll over there and continue their Islamic studies over there. What was the main intention of establishing such a school? I mean, because there was Hawza. And when you take a look at the distance between Hujjatiyya School and the Faiziyya School, you know, what was the main intention of establishing such a school?
As you know, when late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'eri moved to Qom, according to the invitations that was sent toward him, after this event, the numbers of Tullab and clergymen in Qom was increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So this event made it necessary to establish more schools and Islamic seminary schools for students to reside and also participate in the classes and get benefit from teachers.
That's right.
And you know, this is really normal, and it's a norm in Islamic seminaries to build the accommodation beside the classes.
Yes.
So this school was also like the others in this regard. And so that's why he decided to establish such a school.
Mm-hmm.
And beside this, I should mention this story also. This is very important.
Very good.
That it is quoted that once late Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'eri wrote to Marhum Sayyid Hujjat Kamari that if you need something, we are at your service.
Mm-hmm.
And Abdul Karim is eager to assist you and help you.
Okay.
And late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Kukameri responded that, thank you very much. We are in need of Karim more than to Abdul Karim.
Oh.
So this is very important.
Karim referring to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes, because Karim is one of the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay.
Yeah. So,
what a respectful answer it was.
Yes.
Okay.
He didn't reject the offer of late Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim.
Okay.
But he said that we all are in need of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Karim more than Abdul Karim, that's right.
So the establishment of this school is one of the services that he did toward Islamic seminaries, beside establishing a good library inside this school.
Okay. They say that Ayatollah Hujjat Kukameri, one of his interests was protecting the Shiite legacy, including especially the manuscripts, you know, the books, And by establishing such a school, he was after doing so. But the akhlaq of the late Sayyid Muhammad Kukamiri also attracted so many people, especially the students, the akhlaqi courses that he had on his marja'iyya and his qom. And he was really a true reviver beside the other ulama. We can say I have the names over here, the other maraja, like, for example, Sayyid Muhammad Taqi Khansari and Sayyid Saduddin Asad, as the custodians of the Islamic Hawza of Qom. Because, you know, when Ayatollah Abdul Karim Hariri, as he founded this school, he needed some people like deputies or assistants. So he, along the other, we can say, ulama, were in charge of taking care of the affairs. And they say that these Ayatollah, Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Kukamiri, was really, we can say, interested in taking, we can say, the responsibility of taking care of the financial affairs of the students, of the houses, the payments, the monthly payments that are given, you know, out of the Hawza funds to the students of the Tullab on that time. Really great achievements by him.
Something we should take in serious consideration here is that he was really eager to help and assist Islamic seminaries.
Yes.
Even during the life of Sheikh Abdul Karim Hariri, yes, and even after the demise of Sheikh Abdul Karim. But when Sheikh Abdul Karim Rahmatullah Alayhi appoints him beside the two different figures, Said Sadruddin Sadr and Said Muhammad Khansari.
Muhammad Taqi Khansari,
Said Muhammad Taqi Khansari. They, according to the courtesy that they had, they decided to announce another figure as the leader of Islamic Seminary of Qom. And this is very important, because they were at they were at the position of getting the highest level in the Islamic seminary, yes, and maybe many figures, maybe many people, they are eager to achieve such position, but they refrained this position and passed it toward late Ayatollah Sayyid Hossein Burujerdi. This is another important aspect of his life to escape fame, many of us maybe would be eager to follow this issue.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sheikh Mahat, have you any missing point about the life of Sayyid Muhammad?
Maybe for his last moments of his life, it is narrated that his daughter gave him actually some soil of Karbala to take
the Torba.
Blessed Torba of Karbala, to take it as a cure or healing.
For the remedy.
Before he takes that, he is deciding to break his ring, because he was not sure that he is going to stay in this this world anymore. And this is one of the custom of the Maraja.
Yes.
That they will break the ring, which will be used as the seal for all of
their
letters
and
everything.
Or documents.
So he wanted to break this ring, and he was given the Torba of Imam Hussein, and he was not sure that this Torba is going to cure him or not.
Okay.
So he take the khira from the Quran to see what Allah will say, and this verse will come, Lahu da'watul haq. So he will actually make sure that this is the last moment of his life, and this Torba is not supposed to cure him, but as a matter of respect, he is saying that وَآخَرُ زَادِي مَنَ الدُّنْيَا الْتُرْبَ, meaning that, okay, I'm not going to stay anymore, and he breaks the ring.
The ring.
This actually story has been written on the tomb of his grave as well.
Okay, that's all right. So breaking the ring as a sign of showing that I'm not in authority anymore.
Yeah.
Okay.
The letters and the wukala and all monies and homes and everything that would be collected under his name will not be...
So I'm free. I'm absolutely free. I'm not in doubt to anybody or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah. This is a custom of the Maharaja. Sometimes after their death.
Death, that's right.
Yes. The followers of the sons, they will take it.
Okay. But finally, he took the Torba.
Yeah. Okay. Akhiru Zadi.
Akhiru
Zadi. He recites this actually part that Akhiru Zadi min ad-dunya, Torbatul Hussein.
MashaAllah.
The last sustenance.
That's right. The last sustenance or the last thing to take is the Torba of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. That's all right. Really, many lessons we can take from the life of this outstanding man, you know, the religious man, including Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Kukamiri, the founder and the establisher of Hujjatiyah School, which is the we can say, a welcoming place for so many students, especially the foreign students who are interested in continuing their Islamic studies in Islamic Republic of Iran, the holy city of Qom. Jamadi al-Awwal 1372, according to the Hijri lunar calendar, is the day that he passed away in the holy city of Qom, and his body was taken into a chamber very close to the mosque of the Hujjatiya Madrasa, or the Islamic seminary, in the city of Qom, and he is buried over there, the visiting place and the tomb of so many scholars and students nowadays. That's all right. May Allah bless the soul of Sayyid Muhammad Hujjat Kukamari. Thank you, Omar Sheikh Ziyania.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi for your presence in the program, The Teacher. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information and to download for free our other episodes of the program, The Teacher, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. To another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
China and the U.S. are locked in a growing war of words over the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. But now, amid simmering tensions between the superpowers, at the security summit in Singapore, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. During the same event, the Chinese defense minister hit back at the U.S., saying Beijing had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China.
If anyone dares to see Taiwan from China, we will not hesitate to fight. We will fight at all costs, and we definitely will fight to the very end. This is the only choice for China.
I think it was very clear the exchange that General Wei had with Secretary Austin was quite straightforward as far as we understand. And his speech was also, of course, very sharp in terms of outlining what the Chinese were prepared to do if Taiwan would declare for independence. Now, both of these people laid out their positions on this. But the question is still very unclear how far the United States is willing to go in trying to use Taiwan in their attempt to bring together the countries of Asia as a counter to China.
But China also struck a more pacifying tone, calling for a stable China-U.S. relationship. Wei stated that the China-U.S. relation is at a critical and crucial juncture. He added that Beijing believes a stable Sino-U.S. relation serves the interests of both countries and the rest of the world. The Chinese defense minister also noted that China had achieved impressive progress in the field of nuclear weapons. Wei, however, noted that Beijing will only use them for defending the nation, never starting a nuclear war, nor ever use nuclear weapons first. He pointed out that the ultimate purpose of China's nuclear arsenal is to prevent a nuclear war. The Chinese defense minister slammed Washington's new strategy, stating that it will lead to further tension between the two countries.
The reality we are witnessing is different to U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's remarks on the Indo-Pacific strategy. The strategy is an attempt to build an exclusive small group in the name of a free and open Indo-Pacific to hijack countries in the region and target one specific country. It's a strategy to create confrontation to contain and encircle others.
Meanwhile, regional countries also seem to be unaligned with Washington's stance, especially in the light of China's direct investment in Pacific Island countries, which it views as important components of its Belt and Road Initiative.
The Chinese have had a very ambitious and very successful program with the Belt and Road Initiative, which has helped to fill the deficit in infrastructure in the Asia Pacific, and this is only beginning now. What the U.S. has to offer is a system of rules in which these countries must abide by, possibly in order to attain increased trade. But they're really not offering anything concrete other than being associated with the United States and a few other countries.
Washington has made no secret about its stance on China. But the new world order and financial order is taking shape already, and the U.S. is left behind. The U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon has pushed nations who have been targeted closer together. This includes energy-rich powerhouses like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia is changing some of its oil sales to the yuan. Therefore, it now seems that the U.S. is on the losing side of the ongoing rivalry with China, especially considering what many believe to be its failure, both militarily and economically. Rising costs in the U.S. have pushed American citizens to the edge with soaring inflation and the government's inability to control the matter so far. According to the Labor Department, the annual inflation rate rose to 8.6% in May, shattering any hope Americans might have had for relief from the skyrocketing inflation. With inflation hitting the highest rate since 1981, rising cost of living has been squeezing households and putting pressure on policymakers to bring the issue under control. In response to the issue, the U.S. Central Bank has since March been raising interest rates, but the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which has driven up the price of oil and commodities like wheat as it disrupts exports from the two countries, has made tackling the problem more difficult. Polls show a majority of Americans see inflation as the top problem facing the country. Consumer sentiment has plunged and U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings have sunk as Republicans criticize him over the issue. But the U.S. government seems to be more concerned about the conflict in Ukraine, where it has so far given away billions of dollars in weaponry.
This definitely hurts the U.S. economy and Americans, the Biden administration's decision not to push for negotiations between Ukraine and Russia is to many of us inexplicable. It's irrational. It's certainly causing enormous carnage and tragedy in that region. And in addition, it's hurting the United States. You know, the average American, when we go to the gas pump these days, I live in California, I'm paying well over $6 per gallon. This is extremely difficult for many American families. So the Biden administration, I think, has been very unwise and damaging in the policies that have been pushed by Secretary of State Blinken and by Victoria Nuland, both of whom are basically neoconservatives.
The price of gasoline in the U.S. has also witnessed a record high, averaging more than $5 a gallon for the first time. Meanwhile, Biden's attempts of lowering prices, namely a record release of barrels from U.S. strategic reserves, waivers on rules for producing summer gasoline, and leaning on major OPEC countries to boost output, have so far proven to be ineffective.
Certainly, the Biden administration should have foreseen these extremely damaging and disturbing consequences. I think that perhaps their policies are driven by somehow, perhaps they think that seeming warlike will help them at the elections coming up very soon, the midterm elections in November. are of great concern to the administration because Biden's approval rate is extremely low right now. So they're clearly taking actions that they hope will bolster the results of the election in favor of Democrats.
Saudi Arabia and several other OPEC countries have rebuffed requests by the U.S. to boost oil production beyond the gradual amount. This has led to U.S. lawmakers seeking alternatives to the oil cartel to solve their problems. So far, the U.S. Senate has passed a bill called No Oil Producing and Exporting Cartels Act of 2021. The bill, aside from creating complications for oil companies, is intended to protect consumers and businesses from spikes in costs of petroleum. But analysts warn that implementing it could have some dangerous unintended consequences. Many say the move could harm U.S. energy companies more as OPEC members produce oil much more cheaply than U.S. companies.
The Secretary General of the Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the resistance would not remain silent in the face of the Israeli regime's efforts to plunder the country's maritime gas resources. Saeed Hassan Nasrallah made the remark on Thursday after a vessel operated by a Greek company arrived at the Karish gas field in Lebanon's territorial waters to extract gas for the occupying regime. Nasrallah noted the enemy does not recognize the international law and resolutions, reminding that it was not the international regulations, but actually pressure, war of attrition, and resistance that forced the occupying enemy to retreat from the southern Lebanon and the Palestinian enclave of the Gaza Strip.
Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. They have MPs inside, and they can manage to maybe adopt a resolution inside the parliament and then move forward with maybe attacking the Israeli vessels and, their workers and so on, to push them away from their resources and their land.
Hezbollah chief also said that the U.S. and Israel are seeking to afflict Lebanon with hunger and partition. Nasrallah said the Lebanese companies that have pioneered to extract the maritime area's resources have been threatened by the U.S. and Israel, warning that Washington and Tel Aviv were after shaving off a large part of the resource-rich area. Lebanon and Israel took part in indirect talks to discuss maritime demarcation in 2020, but they stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, where Israel has given exploration rights to a Greek firm. The talks were supposed to discuss the Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area, according to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers more further south, including part of Karish. Israel relies heavily on gas and has long been developing a number of illegal offshore gas deposits in the Mediterranean Sea. This is a particularly sensitive issue for Lebanon, which is dealing with fuel shortages amid a worsening economic crisis.
And I'm pretty sure Hezbollah is wise enough to do this with coordination with other political parties inside Lebanon. Hezbollah does not want to control the country and does not want to push the country towards war, but they want to secure their sovereignty, they want to secure their resources, and they want to keep the country a safe country. And Hezbollah has been proven, with all these years, all their sacrifices and their actions. They're a very credible organization inside Lebanon and a political party that has a lot of good allies. And I think that this is a great opportunity, hopefully, to be able to get some more financial support for the Lebanese nation.
Hezbollah says it has the material and military capabilities that enable it to prevent Israel's gas extraction from Karish. The Hezbollah Secretary General has cautioned the Israeli regime against seeking another war on Lebanon, saying the regime's losses would be greater than those of Lebanon in the event of such military confrontation. This is not the first time the regime has sought to encroach on a nation's sovereign territory. But this time,
the response it would receive could be unprecedented.
The U.S. and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN nuclear watchdog's 35-nation board of governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as